The core of Skull and Bones is 15 or 20 families. These are old line families. They came to the United States from England about the 1600s, 1700s. And you've got the Lords and the Wadsworths and the Bushes.
It's Friday. Welcome to the COVID Secure, not the BCFM Politics Show, on Friday, the 1st of April, 2022. We are streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft. Actually, we're all remote this week, and that is based in Bristol. It's an art centre, also at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, hopefully. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, relentlessly gaslighting us with military-grade psychological warfare, propaganda, and what about the medical misinformation? Like an open wound, apparently forgotten now. Of course, ivermectin is just a horse tranquilizer, isn't it? The transmitter and printing press owners hell-bent on turning society into a hostile environment for readers, listeners, and viewers, herding, if they can, tens of millions of innocent, trusting Brits and everyone else around the world into the metaverse. Zuckerberg's little hell, instead navigating us calmly for the most part through the Fourth Reich Matrix or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Hi Martin, how are you this week?
I'm okay, Tony. I'm at home waiting to hear your questions.
Well, my question is, to begin with, is it's nice to see that RT is still doing stuff, and also on they're on Odyssey, various other platforms. It seems as if there's quite an attempt to take RT out. That is to say, we're not supposed to be hearing what the Russian point of view of everything that's going on in the world. Never mind just Ukraine, are we?
No, but I don't suppose that the Russian government or RT are that surprised by this kind of response. And in the real world, people can always find what they want to find if they've got the wherewithal.
Yes, that's right. But I mean, the idea is now that you have to go out and find out what's going on for yourself, because otherwise you'll be just ladled up spoonfuls of propaganda and you won't know what's going on. But then you'll be happy as you begin to know nothing, because you'll be lulled into a false sense of security. Anyway, look, part one this week, we're going to be... apologies, by the way, folks, for being 2 hours late to start. But I mean, that might have annoyed some people, upset people, but just unavoidable, I'm afraid. Part one this week, we'll be really cramming it in over the next couple of hours, so I better shut up and tell you what's going to happen. We've got Mark Watts, who's the hero of XRO News and the VI paedophile scandal, journalist, freelancer. He's also involved very much with the Freedom of Information Centre in London. So anyone that wants to know about Freedom of Information requests, they are there to help. He has, it's basically about a new book out on the Dolphin Square scandals. And Mark has sent a letter to Private Eye to the paedophile protectors there, people like Ian Hislop, asking them for an explanation as to why they have decided just to do a hatchet job on the former MP Simon Danchuk, and also his book, the Dolphin Square book. And also looking at the failure of the Rotherham police to be prosecuted after allowing a massive long load of child abuse to go on there. I think it was nearly 1,300 or 1,500 young girls being abused in Rotherham, being reported to the police. The police did nothing, but we just had the last copper this week let off. No punishment whatsoever. Also looking this week at probate fraud. That is to say, people messing with your will, robbing people from their will. And some very interesting information and lessons to learn from Dr. Mark Jones. Also a new book out called Scanned, which is about digital currencies and about the move toward digital money by journalist Nick Corbishley. And Julian Assange, the third part of four of the 11 year ago interview he did with RT. Looking this week, Julian looks at who's in charge. This is all this way back, the governments or the corporations. And in part two, Joe Biden explains how he sacked, in his own words, boasting actually, about how he sacked the Ukrainian chief prosecutor who was trying to prosecute his son. He explains how he managed to get him sacked. And we ask again, is Ukraine a sovereign country? The answer is obviously no, because the US vice president at the time, he was just saying, well, who can be the chief prosecutor and who can't in Ukraine? And then also he then had the temerity in Poland this week to call for regime change in Russia. This is just the same old script, isn't it? The same old story. I wonder if that was on his cue card, a little cue card saying call for regime change, Joe. Just reading out from someone else's script he's holding in his hand. Also this week, Michael Hudson in part two on the sanctions blowback. Scott Ritter explaining how the CIA uses the UN to start wars and his experience from Iraq. Looking at that today. Mark Sloboda is ex-US military. He explains how what's really going on in Ukraine with the Russian tactics on the ground. What are they actually doing rather than what we're being told? And also he looks at the potential for a nuclear war and the end of the internet. We have also 15 minutes of eschatology at the end with William Stewart this week, Jean-Pierre de Smet, and the good old David Livingston. Anyway, we've been cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia. Iranian and Russian news now cancelled, of course, as well by the telecoms cartel, and then Ofcom, but not cancelled here. So, Martin, we start off with this quite incredible story about the final police officer up in Rotherham being exonerated. It does have echoes, this, of Hillsborough, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, as you know, police often get exonerated for things that they have or haven't done. And this would be I don't know enough about the case, to be honest, to say whether there's any fairness in this whatsoever. But of course, you know, people are bound to ask questions, aren't they?
OK, so let's just start, Martin. This might be an education view. It is all recent stuff. It's all this week. But it's the final police officer who was facing potential prosecution for doing nothing about the massive amounts of child sexual abuse that was going on in Rotherham. I mean, they do have a public duty. It would be quite simple, very, very simple to prosecute these officers for misfeasance or malfeasance. Although I would guess, and this is something which I don't touch on in the interview with Mark Watts here, we're about to hear, it is that it may be that they were instructed to do it by very senior people. In other words, instructed to allow this child sexual abuse to carry on. And of course, that would come out in any subsequent trial, which is why the trial may have been the idea may have been to just, you know, kick this one into the long grass, as has finally happened here. So let's hear now from Mark Watts, freelance journalist, about his letter to it's about the final Rotherham officer being let off this week.
Today we've had the last of 47 police officers in Rotherham on the topic of child abuse to be investigated over the handling of historic allegations of child sexual abuse in Rotherham was cleared of misconduct. So actually nobody has even lost their job as a result of the horrific sexual abuse going on in the town. Many reports to the police of it, but no action taken. Nearly 1,500 girls subjected to sexual exploitation over 16 years. Many officers, something like 50 officers knew of this, had reports directly to them of this sexual abuse going on. Obviously, this is a crime, and yet no action has been taken against them for literally ignoring these crimes going on in the city. Around.
Well, my understanding is that what's happened today is the final officer who was facing, as it were, serious disciplinary action has been cleared. And putting that issue aside, what that means is that apparently nobody at South Yorkshire Police did anything wrong. Now, I'm not saying anything about the individual officer who was cleared today. I know nothing about him or what he actually did or didn't do. Standing back from that, looking at the actions of South Yorkshire Police overall, I mean, it's clear to everyone that there was a massive foul up and apparently no individual officer did anything wrong. And yet, South Yorkshire Police committed this massive foul-up. So that's obviously a very unsatisfactory position. It suggests that there's a systemic problem and or a cultural problem. And it's a little bit difficult to accept the idea that no one did anything wrong at all. Maybe everyone did something wrong. Yes, it's completely appalling. I mean, it's just absolutely appalling.
So that's freelance journalist Mark Watts there, Martin. I mean, there's all sorts of things to say about this, not least of which, of course, this is the same force that was responsible for Hillsborough. Again, no prosecutions.
Well, that's right. And obviously the Hillsborough case I know a bit more about, and clearly the police, not just in South Yorkshire, but in other parts of the country, often get away with doing things they shouldn't have done or not doing things they should have done. But of course, the reason we know about this, I will just put a caveat on that, is because they did in the end prosecute people, and that's how it all, and then they were sent to court, because of course, and sent to prison, because of course Tommy Robinson waded into that and tried to, nearly got them let off by trying to interfere in the court process.
It's interesting, you mentioning Tommy Robinson. Apparently he's going to be in Bristol, isn't he, weekend after this? I think, is it next weekend? Trying to do some sort of far-right march, which is against the Black Lives Matter. In other words, pro-Edward Colston. I mean, I don't know if he knows very much.
Well, I didn't know about that. I suggest to him that's... I mean, we've had anti-Black Lives Matter protests in this city at the time when it all kicked off, two summers ago, but they were relatively very small. You know, there is some support for it, and we talked to some of the people, but the far, far more Black Lives Matter protesters.
Yeah. I mean, what would you say? I mean, I did an article for RT many years ago, which was, it was basically saying that this guy is Tommy Robinson is working for the intelligence services. He's one of those kind of controlled opposition people that everyone flocks to. And I still see quite often stuff from his Telegram channel shared around because, you know, like he's like Ike in a way, like a nutter magnet. So he gets given really good information, some of it much better, which isn't difficult than the BBC. And as a result, a lot of people sort of flock to him and he becomes followed. And therefore, the idea, I think, is to sort of almost like control the crowd, control the campaign.
Well, I think it's very suspicious that the English Defence League grew up at exactly the same time as Al-Majah Haroun. So I think it was the Royal Anglian Regiment were marching through Luton. Al-Majah Haroun turned up, were basically an MI5 front organisation, in my view, claiming, you know, they wanted to see British soldiers, beheaded or whatever. And then at the very same...
Abu Hamza's lot.
Captain Hook, who was definitely an MI5 agent.
And they were involved in the 7-7 thing, weren't they?
Yes, right.
Apparently, but the same arranging for the 7-7 alleged bombers to come to London that day. So, you know, this was, and I think there were actually many Muslims at the mosque in London, Finsbury Park, who were saying, look, get these guys out of here. They're intelligence agents.
That's right. But they came into public view at this march by the Royal Anglian Regiment. But at the same time, there was a counter demonstration by the newly formed English Defence League, led by one John Yaxley Lennon, otherwise known as Tommy Robinson. Now, what this strikes me as is very similar to what happened in Italy in the 1970s, where both far right and far left groups were created out of whole cloth by the intelligence services in order to try and bamboozle the population down a certain direction.
That's absolutely
right. And I think
right,
that Tommy fits that to a T.
Definitely. Well, it'd be interesting to see if he shows his face in Bristol in a couple of weeks' time. Anyway, the reason I'm, you know, this going back to Rotherham, this is also, you know, the idea here that you've got Pakistanis and Asians who are being deliberately allowed to, protected really by the police, to abuse young, mostly white girls. I mean, this is almost setting up a kind of race hate cauldron here, Martin.
Well, I've seen, as I say, I haven't followed this in detail. I'm more of a political economy man, Tony. But what I've seen from various Muslim community leaders in Rotherham is saying, look, what these guys have all got in common is that they'd all work in the taxi trade, and that sort of, and which tends to be dominated by Muslims.
Yeah.
They're the people who are out all night picking people up, moving them from A to B, and moving drugs around, perhaps, and so on. So it's not really there. It's not really there. It's because of the nature of what they do.
It's also very
that they're involved in this sort of thing.
This sort of thing is very handy for the mafia, isn't it? They've got a whole load of girls they can recruit.
That's right. Well, I mean, things like taxi firms and massage parlors and all the rest of it. It's all part of a kind of, you know, a nexus. And this is where these kind of things take place. And it's not really to do with the I think possibly the reluctance to prosecute may have come about because of sensitivities about the racial aspects of it. But it's not really, you know, people who do these things are not. I mean, there's nothing in the Quran that says you should go around abusing young girls. No, in actual fact, it's forbidden. No,
exactly. I mean, this is very important. Actually, I mean, it may simply be that the chief constable of South Yorkshire Police or the deputy chief constable was taking two salaries, one from the public and one from the local hoods.
Well, it may also be. Tony.
And that might, of course, if any of these people were prosecuted, that may come out in a court case. Any of these police were prosecuted. Anyway, look. The second piece we've got with Mark Watts is this letter to Ian Hislop about the book by Simon Danchuk, Scandal at Dolphin Square.
This really concerns the issue of what's sort of become known as VIP paedophiles, so evidence of various people in elite positions over many, many years of having sexually abused children and basically getting away with it because of who they are or who they were. And Private Eye, I mean, admittedly, in common with much of the media, has very much joined the bandwagon to say that it's all so much stuff and nonsense. And they've rather taken in recent years to attacking any survivors who've come forward with testimony or may have written a book or whatever it may be, as well as whistleblowers or journalists who are working in this area. And it's curious because I think for a lot of people from the outside, because long ago Private Eye had something of a track record of uncovering evidence of this kind of thing. So in fact, Private Eye was quite early in terms of exposing specifically Cyril Smith in the wake of some disclosures by a small kind of alternative paper up in Rochdale. But that's largely down to the work of a lot of this was being pursued by Paul Foote, the late Paul Foote, who of course worked for Private Eye. And I think in many ways, Private Eye sorely misses him and his influence. Because in recent years, as I say, it's taken to attacking anybody who has sought to suggest that there is a significant problem of people, members of the elite, over the years having sexually abused children and not being prosecuted, notwithstanding the stacks of evidence that's now emerged in terms of failure to prosecute several former MPs at the time and other VIP figures, the old ambassador and so on. And just recently they've published a series of these articles that appear from time to time, which was specifically about an article that I had written for the Foyer Centre, because Foyer Centre has a news site, so there's some articles about some sort of an array of subjects there, and I'd written about in fact a book that's just been published by Simon Danchuk. And his co-author Dan Smith. And then Simon Danchuk did quite a lot of the work a few years ago in terms of really bringing to light a lot of details about Cyril Smith specifically, because he was the MP for the same seat many years, obviously, after Cyril Smith had died. And Simon and Dan had written a book called, it's just come out, called Scandal at Dolphin Square, which is mostly about an array of curious figures, shall we say, curious or interesting, or possibly both, who've lived at Dolphin Square and been involved in one scandal or another. And they tackle the subject specifically of child sexual abuse in there. And one of the things that they do, and the main part of that section of the book, is some statements that were signed by a former detective at the Metropolitan Police, who'd worked for the paedophile unit there, who gave details of what had hitherto, up until the signing of his statement at least, been a secret operation that the Met carried out dating from the late, basically dating into the late 90s, into allegations of child sexual abuse at sex parties involving political, government and military figures at Dolphin Square and other locations. And he describes in these statements how Met bosses and Special Branch thwarted this investigation. Now, this statement, he signed a couple of statements for the Met for its more recent Operation Winter Key, which was looking back at these sort of old cases, if you like. And these statements were, in fact, passed to the government inquiry into child sexual abuse. And curiously, it's been hugely ignored. I mean, the media at large has totally ignored it. The only coverage it got when this material first came to light was in a Twitter thread that I had put out back in 2016 when this evidence first, as it were, became public. And it was totally ignored by the media at the time. But this book goes into some detail about these statements. And Private Eye did this very skewed article sort of about the book, about what I had written about the book, as it were, and sort of as Private Eye has taken to doing, to sort of dismissing and kind of turning up what I call turning a blind eye to the evidence. So they completely ignore the stuff about this former detective and just engages in sort of name calling and being very dismissive of the idea, you know, that there's an issue concerning VIP pedophiles. So my letter essentially took issue with why have you ignored this this extraordinary evidence which has surfaced, which everyone seems to be so keen to ignore. The book's not all about that. I mean, the section that's about child sexual abuse is predominantly about this material from this former detective at the Met. Have I had a reply? No. Private Eye has something of a track record of never publishing rights to reply. It does this very unusual journalistic practice of never contacting people. They've written about me and people I know around this issue, as I say, repeatedly over recent years, and they frequently do not contact people in advance of publication, and they constantly get things wrong as a consequence of that failure to carry out basic journalistic exercises. And then having got something wrong or having misled their readers over one thing or another, certainly my experience has been if you write a letter, short letter for publication, they just ignore it, don't publish it.
Well, it's very easy, isn't it, to ignore something that you don't want to hear. You just put it in the bin, but it ain't journalism, Mr. Hislop. So the book is called Scandal at Dolphin Square, A Notorious History by Simon Danchuk and Daniel Smith, the first book to tell the scandal-filled story of Dolphin Square, the UK's most notorious address. Just a brief description. In 1937, Dolphin Square was built in London's Pimlico, a major development offering 1,250 flats to well-to-do private individuals. From the outset, it attracted the great and the good, in particular, a long roll call of MPs and celebrities. It was perhaps inevitable that scandal would follow not far behind. Anyway, this is the story of the square, says Mr. Danchuk. And also, of course, there's a whole section on the evidence given by this former Met Police paedophile investigator. So, Martin, this whole business of the VIP paedophiles, I know we do repeat many times on here, it looks as if the establishment was most definitely protecting this. And one of those reasons, there may have been many reasons, but one certainly was that this was used for blackmail.
Yeah, I think I always mention in this context the Kinkora Boys Home in Northern Ireland, because it's understood across the political spectrum in Northern Ireland that MI5 were using the young boys in the home as, sexual bait for blackmailing political figures in Northern Ireland. Most of the people they were blackmailing were loyalist paramilitary leaders who had a very straight-laced image. But it shows that the intelligence services were quite clear that they were going to use blackmail of this sort, using underage children, and nothing's ever been done about it. Ken Livingstone made his first maiden speech in the House of Commons when he was elected as an MP for Kilburn on this very topic, And of course, that was very controversial because he made the speech. It's supposed to be, hello, how are you? But of course, he used parliamentary privilege to good advantage to bring all this to light. But still, nobody's been punished, and nobody from the intelligence services is likely to be punished. But people need to understand what they do.
We certainly do. This, then, they say, is the story of the square, not of its topography, but of its people, an extraordinary array of characters who've borne witness to and been pivotal in some of the most scandalous episodes in the 20th and 21st centuries, a story replete with mysterious deaths, espionage, illicit love affairs, glamour, politics and scandal, from Oswald Mosley, the carry-on gang, the Profumo affair, to these allegations we were just discussing there and Private Eye were dismissing of VIP sexual abuse rings. Amazing, though, isn't it, Martin, what's happened with Private Eye? As Mark was saying there, it started off exposing people like Cyril Smith, and now it's covering up for that ilk.
Well, I mean, they've all got feet of clay, haven't they? Let's face it. And Private Eye, again, as a, it's not regulated by Ofcom or anything. They don't, they're under no obligation to print letters
from
people who criticise them and so on.
They've sold out.
They're just another voice.
They've sold out. I always remember the, because his lot was approached by, what's his name? The journalist with the story about Jimmy Savile, Miles Goslett, who had met one of my old colleagues and got the story from her from Newsnight about Jimmy Savile, and he refused to print it. Then they went along to he spent about a year going round with the story to all these editors in London. This is why I call the London media, you know, God, what an awful lot. And eventually he managed to get hold of Richard Ingrams at the Oldie magazine, who published the story. And of course, there shouldn't have been any problem about anything like libel, because Savile was dead by at that point. And that's why Liz McKean had actually interviewed people for Newsnight, because, you know, he's gone, he can't prosecute you for libel anymore. But it was all of his establishment chums that were protecting him all around London, and with their leverage in the London on over the London editors, the useless London editors. About a year and a half after that was published in the Oldie, and the whole scandal broke, and, you know, around the world, and Richard Ingrams was sacked as editor of the Oldie. So this shows you how it works. Money, money, money. That's all it's about. Anyway, look, I'm talking about money. Of course, there has been a lot of efforts over the last decade or so, you know, obviously before that too, to make sure that parents can't pass houses on to their kids and that all children have to start at the bottom of the ladder. Now, one wonders what incentive there is to get a house if you can't ever pass it on to anybody and it just gets taxed as you die. And so you can't pass property onto children, and that's just one way in which, you know, you can be cheated, whether it's by the government or by somebody else, when your parents die. So we've got an item now which is looking quite closely at this whole issue of probate fraud. So in other words, the defrauding people of things which are actually there, not the government do it, but unscrupulous solicitors and unregulated individuals doing this apparently willy-nilly now. Now, that, Martin, this looks to me like it's almost a spin-off from what we were talking about with Rowan Bosworth Davis, and we have been on and off for years, about the idea that now any kind of fraud pretty much in Britain is allowed. If you can get away with it, it's very unlikely to get prosecuted. Anyway, look, rather than chat to you about it now, let's have a listen to Dr. Mark Jones discussing probate fraud and these unregulated individuals who are taking over the wills and the way that the whole probate thing is organised, and also unscrupulous solicitors too.
When your loved one dies, you hopefully have a document that you can show in court or to the authorities that show that was their last wishes. The problem you've got is the lawyers alter these wills, make themselves the managers of the wills, and it becomes very difficult to remove them. And because they have got such clout and power, their wishes, the lawyers' wishes, can overtake the wishes of the wills, which you wouldn't believe happens because they're signed and dated and they're in front of people. But if the lawyers want to, they will use their friends to get the will which they want to be done so they can control the inheritance and rip the estate off to every penny it's got.
Okay, so what was your own experience with your mum? Is she still with us?
No, sadly, my mum died in 2015. So with my mum's case, to abbreviate it, mum died in 2015. It was a very distressing, horrific death, which I, you know, was quite traumatizing. This lawyer then, who had taken over mum's will, took it to his advantage. He said my mum's property was only worth $450,000, which we clearly knew was not true because we'd had previous offers of $700,000 or $800,000. This lawyer also said there was a £100,000 debt, which didn't exist. It took 5 years of us going through the court system to find out the $100,000 debt, which he said existed, was in fact only $10,000. Finally, after removing this lawyer, they appointed a new lawyer, and he started covering up the mistakes of the first lawyer. And then what happened then was this new lawyer appointed a Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors expert to look at my mum's property. But when he looked at the property, he said it was only $345,000, which was a lie. He clearly did an analysis on properties which weren't like my mother's. So he didn't do what was like-minded. And if you look at the properties in my mum's area, all of them are worth $800,000. He didn't know about the property across the road, which was a third of the size of my mum's property, which went for $490,000. He cooked the books. And then what happened was the new appointed lawyer ignored that he had lied. The Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors tried to ignore all this going on. They've been reprimanded last year for all these strange valuations being allowed to go on. And then what happened was this new lawyer listed my mother's property last year for $500,000 on a website, which was an auction site, which nobody could bid on. And now we know why he did that, because next door, mum had died. The same lawyer who had done all the dirty tricks to me, the first lawyer, had said to them their mother's property was only $400,000. He'd done that to try and take advantage of the situation. And the second lawyer had listed in my mum's property as $450,000 to make the property look all cheap in the area. And then what happened was 2 weeks later, the semi-detached other half of the property went for $740,000. So what you have is one building, one half went for $740,000. The other half, which is controlled the lawyers, said was only $400,000. And we caught them out. They were caught out. And then we sat in front of the same judge as we had in 2019, in 2021, and he ignored all this. And it was extraordinary. I have friends who were attending the court hearing, and they all thought he was corrupt, and it was the most bizarre cover-up you could imagine, because not only did the second lawyer who took over mum's estate list it for $500,000, he constantly tried to reduce its value, because by doing that, he was covering up the first lawyer who tried to get it for $450,000. And through a subject access request from the law firms themselves, we now know there were several buyers from my mum's property for $1 million. So they deliberately ignored it. And then the other thing I should explain was in 2015, when my mum died, because I'm a medical researcher, I went around the undertakers, befriended the undertakers, had tea with the undertakers, even got offered a job to work at an undertakers. And what did I find at the undertakers? I found people coming in saying their mothers had died very strangely, horrifically, and the same lawyers were taking over the wills and trying to control and getting their properties cheap. That is, and then as I further researched it, this is going on all over the country. It's a network of, it's a cartel, where they're trying to control the wills, they're trying to put bills into the estate which don't exist, they're trying to undervalue the property so nobody will realise it. And the truth of the matter is the people they're doing to are all in grief. They've all lost their loved ones, and that's how they're trying to get away with it.
Dr. Mark Jones there relating his horrific experience. Mark Martin, it just sounds to me like organised crime going on here with the various bodies that are there to overlook, like the Law Society, solicitors, and even now they've got many of these unregulated probate people. They're totally inadequate, so these people are able to continue, and there's no sort of sanctions. It reminds me a little bit of Rotherham.
Well, I mean, obviously that's the first I've heard of this particular case. It reminds me of the philosophical problem. All lawyers are liars. I am a lawyer. And, you know, there's bound to be scope for for bad behavior in the legal profession because they know the rules.
Yes, there certainly. Well, I think the main problem is that the court system is falling apart and it's just unreliable. That once you get some crooked lawyers, I mean, we had the situation, didn't we, with Lloyds Bank in Bristol, who were very much involved with some senior detectives in Avon and Somerset Police. As soon as we got a new police and crime commissioner, Lloyds Bank shipped out of town. Anyway, we've got another clip from Mark, which is a little bit more positive and upbeat. So in order to make sure you don't get robbed by one of these crooked solicitors over probate and the will, I asked Mark, what's the best way to actually get a will made to make sure that they can't take advantage of it?
Video the person making the will. I'd make sure they would demonstrate they had mental capacity. I would make sure that they demonstrated they understood the consequences, what was going to happen. Have all the family members, if you could, have them there in the room so they understand that would be what the will's going to be. And they would also appoint the family members as future executors, people who would manage the will, and it wouldn't be left down to these lawyers who are outsiders who are looking to carve up your family.
It's funny we had this item, thanks very much to Dr. Mark Jones. It's funny because this week I just happened to bump into a friend who'd had a similar sort of problem with a will. He was offered £30,000 to say that it wasn't his signature as a witness on the will, and he said no. And then he had his life threatened. They had someone sent him popped a card through his letterbox with someone, a threat with a guy with a gun. Pointing at him, which is, you know, so this sort of stuff most definitely does go on. Anyway, on to another subject now, and we're going to hear now from Nick Corbishley. Nick is a journalist who's living out in Spain, but he's done a terrific book, which is called Scanned. It's looking specifically at the massive move towards digital money. We have had the old-fashioned paper versions of the £20 and the announcement that the £20 and £50 paper money is going to be withdrawn in September this week, and more. I mean, you might say move towards the cashless society, but, you know, we're going all towards all this plastic money now, or polymer money, I think they call it. And the Bank of England do guarantee there is no RFID chip in there anywhere. Of course, there might be some other technology which can be used to track those notes around. But anyway, that's not what we're here to discuss. We're really just here to look at this book by Nick Corbishley, where he looks at what he sees as the real great reset, that is these central bank digital currencies and also programmable currencies which can determine what you will be allowed to spend your money on.
When we talk about digital money, it's very important to be clear what we mean. So, I mean, like, we use digital money all the time. When we pay with a credit card, when we pay with a debit card, when we pay with our mobile phones. So, I mean, like, these are forms of digital money. What we should be clear about is that in the not too distant future, there are almost 90 central banks on the planet that are very interested in creating central bank digital currencies. And this is a whole different kettle of fish. And most people are not even aware that this is happening. A central bank digital currency will revolutionize the way money works. It will provide much greater power to the central banks to control the money supply. It will allow them to track and trace everything we spend money on, everywhere we receive money from. And they've said this in very, very clear language. So you've got the president of the Bank of International Settlements, Agustin Carstens, the Bank of International Settlements is the central bank of central banks. And he said, you know, if you've got somebody spending £1,000 or $1,000, then it's impossible to know what they're spending their money on. It's impossible to know where that money is going. But when we have central bank digital currencies, we have virtually total control over that whole, you know, the whole direction of the money and how that works. I paraphrase there, But I mean, like, this degree of control is essential. And at the same time, we have recently we had a report coming out of the Financial Times, which featured a senior Goldman Sachs banker. He was saying that there's the only way you could possibly have a central bank digital currency is if you have a digital identity, if everybody has a digital identity. So these two things go hand in hand. Without the digital identity, there cannot be central bank digital currencies. So it's about how, you know, before you are able to put into effect this completely electronic system of money controlled by central banks, everybody needs to have their own digital identity. And this opens up huge new avenues for government to track and trace us, but also to control our actions. So like we saw in Canada, it will be possible for central banks to stop certain people from being able to transact. It will be much easier for them to do so. They would not need to pass new laws or anything like that. And there's also been talk in the Bank of England about programmable digital money or programmable central bank digital currency. This means that the central bank will be able to decide what people can spend their money on. It completely transforms the way money functions. There's also the possibility that we will start receiving universal basic income, which is becoming, you know, we're seeing more and more countries going down this route. Canada is very close to launching its own UBI. I think that Ireland is talking about doing that. So you've got more and more countries that are talking about launching universal basic income, and they would be doing this probably on a time limited basis. So you will receive essentially free money, but it will be probably replacing most welfare based money. And that money will be in your account for a very brief period of time, and you will have to spend it. So I think that what a lot of people don't realize is one of the beautiful things about cash is that you can actually have it in your hands. It can belong to you. You can take it out of your bank if you want. You can have it under your bed. You can have your own money. But I mean, like, in a purely digital money system, your money is always residing in one account or another, one digital account or another, or it is moving between accounts. You will never, ever be able to access it. If there is a bank run, if there is a bail-in, what we call a bail-in, which is when a bank goes under, and in order to recapitalize it, they use money belonging to the creditors of that bank, including bondholders and shareholders, but also depositors, you may suddenly find that part of your savings have been used to recapitalize that bank, and you will not be able to do anything about it. And this is the thing. It really is divorcing you from control over your money. So it is a revolutionary change. And yet there is no discussion, there's no conversation, there's no national debate.
No national debate. In fact, I'm in the longer version. I have quite a chat with Nick about the whole idea of the way that money is used, things like getting rid of checkbooks, the idea of, you know, slowly but surely getting rid of cash, going from signing a chitty every time you use your debit card or credit card over to the pins and now on to contactless. None of this is there any public debate whatsoever. Martin, what do you make of what he was saying there about the way money is heading?
Well, money has always been a source of debate. I mean, money is a means of control, even as cash. So when we're talking about universal basic income, they can withdraw it if they don't like you. Well, that's pretty much like the old job seekers allowance or previous benefits. So money is the main mechanism of control in capitalist society. This is just another turn of the screw.
Well, the idea of
a very big, important turn of the screw.
the idea of arbitrarily withdrawing benefits, I mean, you know, that it was seen that, you know, you're basically getting your social security. That was an absolute guaranteed right up until the Cameron government came along. And then they started saying, oh, well, actually, we're just going to give you no money for a few weeks, no money for a few months, and tough. But anyway, look, we've got another clip also with Nick, and it's a brilliant book, this digital money book. It's called Scanned. And Nick's done a superb job in looking at exactly what these CBDCs are that we are about to be they're about to be thrust upon us. I think really that looking at the way that the system operates, it's very similar to, I mean, if there is only something that you can, you know, certain things you can spend your money on, what we're doing here is we're moving along towards the social credit type system. And also, of course, we're getting more and more pushed into things like the universal basic income by an absolute destruction of the economy by the banksters. But anyway, in our second clip, Nick talks about, you know, the actual surveillance side of this new money system, a digital money system that's chugging down the tracks towards us.
We're going through, I would argue, the most turbulent moment in history since probably the Second World War. So, I mean, like, I would prefer to say where we'll be in 5 years' time or even where we'll be in 5 months' time. But if we do go down the road of, like, purely digital, everything digital, we're going to be living in a much more controlled societies where our ability to maybe express ourselves, our ability to move, our ability to transact, our ability to work, our ability to associate with certain people are going to be significantly impacted. I think that one of the great tragedies of our current moment is that we are probably not, we don't value the things that genuinely bring value to our lives. And so, I mean, like, we take for granted things like the freedom of speech, things like freedom of association, freedom of movement. Although, I mean, like, that has probably changed a little bit since the pandemic. I mean, it's, you only start really valuing those things when you actually lose them. And if you go to a genuine dictatorship and you ask people, you know, what it's like not to be able to say what you think about the government, then I think that, you know, you will get a very different answer, although they probably wouldn't tell you because they'd be too afraid. I think that is this, you know, the what awaits us is going to be a world of not just much greater control. I think it's going to be a world of far greater inequality. So if the current trends continue, we're going to see the wealthy continue probably to get bailed out, continue to get insulated from the consequences of economic crises, while those in the middle classes, those in the lower classes are going to feel the effects and they're going to get poorer. It's going to be much harder for large people, you know, for large parts of the population to participate in the economy. So we're likely to see more and more people being pushed out to the fringes, into the margins. I mean, I don't think the benefits for most people are not very clear to me. I mean, apart from basic convenience, but those who really will benefit from that basic convenience will be people who are probably in the kind of like much upper, you know, the higher echelons of society, and especially the super, super wealthy, the, you know, the political, business and financial elite.
So that's Nick Corbishley there, author of the book just out called Scanned. I'm going to see if I can't tell you exactly what the subtitle of it is. I'll probably do that in a minute. But Martin, you know, he's talking about massive, massive changes in society, isn't he, really? And a system which enables the elite. We're talking here about the banksters here, the ones that got bailed out by us, by the way, in 2008 and have totally impoverished the government. They've gotten by the short and curlies now. That's what they plan to do with us, to tell us what we, whether or not we are going to be able to have a life or not by switching on and off our bank accounts.
Well, there are two levels to this, aren't there? The one is the actual, you know, surveillance fear and the fact that, you know, government's going to be able to control what you can spend your money on and all of that. The other is the more basic point is, why did we bail the banks out? These are political power questions rather than technical questions. I mean, a few years ago, the Modi government in India tried to get rid of all large denomination cash notes, and you had to hand them in. They said it was to try and get rid of corruption and so on. But of course, India is a country where perhaps more than half the population don't even have a bank account. And this is where I think a lot of this digital stuff breaks down. You know, a lot of people are living hand to mouth in very extreme circumstances, and they live on cash. And the idea that they're all going to be digitalized in the slums in Delhi, I think, is fantasy. But of course, it's much more likely to happen in developed countries where everybody's used to using electronic money anyway. But the real problem is who's in power and what are they trying to do to us? It's not just a question of how they're doing it. It's a question of what they're trying to do.
No, I agree. Anyway, so the book is called Scanned. The actual subtitle of it is Why Vaccine Passports and Digital IDs Will Mean the End of Privacy and Personal Freedom. The author, the wonderful author, Nick Corbishley there. And that is literally just out in the last couple of weeks. Lovely to get an interview with him. And I think it'd be also interesting to, if you'd like to hear the longer version of that interview, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, along with all of the interviews generally that I do on here, including the one we previously heard from Mark Watts, where he explains a lot about freedom of information requests, for example, in the longer interview, and how you can do things like that. But I thought part three of our four parts of the 11 years ago interview with Julian Assange we're going to have now, and it really I think is interesting how what Nick was saying it actually harmonizes in many ways with what Julian Assange says in this interview about who really runs the show. And this is the third of four, and this is about 9 minutes long, but of a longer interview that Laura Smith did with Julian Assange back in 2011. So let's hear from Julian now.
The Guardian, despite portraying itself as a sort of bastion of free speech and information freedom, do you think it's allowed itself to be influenced by state interests here?
What happens in the West is that there is no border between state interest and commercial interest. The edges of the state, as a result of privatization, are fuzzed and blurred out into the edges of companies. So in traditional societies, you have companies and you have the state, and they are distinctly different entities. But in the West, which is sort of has the most advanced financial flows and communications flows, these have blurred out into each other. So you can't tell the boundaries between one and the other. So you see in the West, the court system are being hijacked by corporate entities to deploy police to seize assets. So that's an example of the control of the most important elements of the state, the ability to deploy coercive force by corporate interests. And so when you look at how The Guardian behaves or how The New York Times behaves, it is part of that mesh of corporate and state interests seamlessly blurring into each other. The Guardian's concerned predominantly about being criticised by these powerful interests, about lawsuits occurring against it, driven by oligarchs, driven by people powerful enough to push a court case forward.
Let's talk a tiny bit about Bradley Manning. He stands accused of leaking classified information to WikiLeaks. He's now being moved to a longer term detention facility whilst accusations abound that he's being mistreated whilst awaiting trial. Do you feel responsible for what's happening to him?
Bradley Manning is the United States' most important political prisoner. He is in prison, it is alleged, as a result of giving material to the media. Now, whether he did give material to the media or not is irrelevant. The United States government believes, or is saying they believe, that that he has, and they are prosecuting him under that basis. So it is the obligation of all journalists and media organisations to protect him, to protect the integrity of their endeavour, which is to get information out to the public. Now, in relation to Bradley Manning's alleged connection to us, we don't know whether he is one of our sources, indirectly connected to one of our sources, not one of our sources at all. What we do know is that he is in prison as a result of the United States' attack against us. He has been swept up in that somehow. So we have an obligation to try and draw attention to his cause. It is not always helpful to him for us to do that. It would not be in his interest to seem to be WikiLeaks in the United States, for example. The attacks on us have been very, very aggressive, the calls for our assassination and so on. So I don't believe it's in his interest for us to be seen to be pushing his cause too much, but we encourage everyone else to try and draw attention and light to the very serious situation that he faces.
You are at the centre of what's turned into an enormous media storm over the US embassy cables, which some have described as essentially sort of diplomats using schoolboy humour to describe each other, little sort of earth-shattering news.
No, it's complete nonsense. It's complete nonsense.
Why this media storm? Why the furore?
Well, it's about power. The material is impactful. It is, if you like, half the State Department's brain. The State Department is the institution of the United States that promotes the interests of particular groups within the United States across the entire world. Those groups are predominantly big, powerful US companies, defense industries, and some of the US bureaucracy. It promotes those interests. It is the communications records of it promoting those interests and also gathering intelligence on the diplomatic intelligence on the countries that it's involved in. And that is quite interesting to the local population of those countries. So whenever material which cannot be argued against directly, like this, is released, everyone knows that it's true. There's no question about its veracity as legitimate documents. We see people trying to take another approach. Every one of the releases that we have done, we have had people go, nothing to see there, move along. But who are those people? Well, they're of two types. They are either the organisations that are directly affected. So we saw in our release of the Afghan war diaries, the Obama administration come out and said, we already know all that. Well, of course they already know all that. It is their material. It is from the Pentagon. Of course they knew all that, but the rest of the population didn't know it all. And we see media organisations that are either apologists for the state or the big corporations we've exposed, or just don't have the story, come out and say, well, there's no story there. So you saw, for example, on the first day of the release of the cables, the Washington Post come out and say, there's nothing really to read there. Well, the Washington Post at that time was not our partner in this endeavor. Subsequently, many of those organizations have come out and said, well, actually, there is something to read there.
Something else that you released at the end of last year was a list of sites that were vulnerable to terrorist attack.
Well, that's not our description of those sites. Actually, what we released last year was evidence, proof, of US diplomats engaging in espionage activities, which is contrary to the UN Charter. So we did that with an order by Hillary Clinton telling diplomats to go and steal people's DNA, their credit cards, their frequent flyer numbers, their passwords, etc. And we did it with this document, which instructed US diplomats to not contact anyone in the host country and ferret out information about bits of the US empire, particularly important bits of the US empire. And those included even gas pipeline pipelines in Ukraine and Russia, you know, pieces that the United States government thought were critical to the operations of its empire. And the people living next to that material and the people of those countries have the right to know that they are considered to be part of the United States empire in terms of provision of material. In addition, the UN and everyone else has the right to know that US diplomats are acting as spies.
But doesn't that also, I mean, you can't guarantee who's going to read and who's not going to read this information. Doesn't that also leave these sites incredibly vulnerable to people who, even you, might not want to know this information?
No, not at all. This sort of material, I mean, there's many more detailed things about assays of things that have been, could be terrorist targets. The material, what we released was simply a material that said name of country plus a gas pipeline. You know, these weren't geographic coordinates, no security details, etc. So compared to the other information that is already out there in the public domain, this is of no significance in terms of terrorism. It is a significance in terms of showing US diplomats engage in espionage, and what all the pieces are feeding the US empire. And by empire, I don't mean some Chomsky Marxist description. What I mean is the raw material that feeds the United States military, the raw material that feeds the big defense contractors, because that's what's in this list.
Well, that's Julian Assange speaking 11 years ago in 2011 to Laura Smith from RT. You know, that channel that we're not allowed to watch because it's so evil. Martin, he's talking there about Ukraine, isn't it? Interesting, about pipelines in Ukraine, how actually Ukraine is part of a US empire.
Well, no doubt we will be going to discuss the Ukraine situation later in the show. But of course, it's another textbook case of the way the US empire operates, isn't it?
It is. And I wonder, actually, it was quite nice to hear him at the beginning talk about really the idea of corporate power and the government in Britain being kind of merged, really. Now, this starts to sound and smell to me like Mussolini's corporatism.
Well, in a sense it is, but it's not exactly the same configuration, is it? I mean, I'm working at the moment with a guy from Spain, and in Spain in the 1970s and 1980s, there was a fascist dictatorship which was part of NATO. And of course, in Greece, there was a military regime that came to power in 1967, which was part of NATO. The Greek army was an integral part of NATO.
Kind of, I reckon, like almost like fascism with a bit of PR.
Yes, but what I was going to go on to compare it was with I was chatting to him and saying, comparing it with Italy, where there was ostensibly a democratic regime, but the NATO intelligence services carried out Operation Gladio, which led to hundreds of deaths, but they also kidnapped the prime minister of the country and assassinated him. That's what the claims are made by Imposimato, the senior judge in Italy.
Most definitely happened. It's what Putin very recently called a decorative democracy. And I can remember a quote from a guy called John Dewey, who I don't really know much about. Do you know much about John Dewey?
John Dewey invented the Dewey system by which all books are, library books are catalogued.
Anyway,
he's most famous for, but he was a sort of liberal guy.
Anyway, one of his quotes is, "Politics is the shadow cast over society by big business." And I think it's exactly what Julian is talking about there. Anyway, we're going to come back after the break looking at, hearing directly from the horse's mouth, Biden explaining how he sacked the Ukrainian chief prosecutor who was about to prosecute his son, Hunter Biden. And many, many more other things. We're going to be hearing from Michael Hudson about the sanctions blowback, and also ex-US military involved in the strikes on Yugoslavia, Mark Sloboda, who's now teaching in Moscow, about the actual military tactics, what are really going on the ground over in Ukraine, as well as our usual little look at eschatology at the end after the break.
Jesus, full-time layabout. I wanna be a layabout. A genuine 24 carat layabout. And if I wanna be a layabout, I'm gonna be a layabout. A 24-hour day layabout. I ain't nothing but a layabout. I ain't nothing but a layabout. Oh no, 24 hours a day. And I don't wanna be a runabout. Well, what's the point in going out? Cause I'm a genuine 24 carat layabout. And if I wanna be a layabout, what's wrong with being a layabout? A 24 hour a day layabout. I ain't nothing but a layabout. I ain't nothing but a layabout. Oh no. Of the rich
Jerusalem, and the William Blake did the lyrics, and it's about, isn't it, about Joseph of Arimathea visiting Glastonbury. I'm not sure if that really happened or not. That's not such an easy one to figure. And also it was the music by Sir Hubert Parry. And then we had from 1994 the New Biles and Layabout. So we're going to start part two of not the BCFM politics show, for those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner, with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We're going to start by having a listen to a certain Mr. Joe Biden as he explains what a few years ago to the Council on Foreign Relations about how he got Ukraine's chief prosecutor sacked.
I went over, I guess, the 12th, 13th time to Kyiv, and I was supposed to announce that there was another $1 billion loan guarantee. And I had gotten a commitment from Poroshenko and from Yatsenyuk that they would take action against the state prosecutor, and they didn't. So they said they were walking out to press conference. Said, "No," I said, "I'm not going to, we're not going to give you the $1 billion." They said, "You have no authority. You're not the president." The president said, I said, "Call him." I said, "I'm telling you, you're not getting $1 billion." I said, "You're not getting the billion. I'm going to be leaving here." And I think it was, what, 6 hours? I looked, I said, "I'm leaving in 6 hours. If the prosecutor's not fired, you're not getting the money." Well, son of a bitch. Got fired. And they put in place someone who was solid.
So I suppose someone who's solid, Martin, means someone who will do what the United States tells them.
Absolutely. I mean, it's very revealing, isn't it? But he was speaking to what he thought was a friendly audience there. And of course, he sounded far more compos mentis than he does these days. And he's basically boasting that he can get things fixed in Ukraine by threatening to withdraw, you know, imaginary money that the Ukrainians are going to be lent. And that pretty much sums up the relationship between the regime in Kiev and its true masters in the United States of America, doesn't
it? It's interesting, isn't it, the involvement of the IMF in all of this as well?
Well, the IMF is essentially a front for the United States of America. They have a, you know, they've got a controlling share in it. And one of the things that may happen as a result of the changes in the financial world going on in the last 10 days is that the Chinese and the Russians are going to set up an alternative to the IMF. I think that's definitely what they're talking about.
This whole business with Hunter Biden, though, there are two sides to it, aren't there? One is the way that Biden was being prosecuted over in Ukraine, which his dad, when he was vice president, managed to stop that. I mean, this is just mafia tactics. But also the laptop. Hunter Biden laptop shows family may have been involved in racketeering. Now, this is Rudy Giuliani saying this. In light of Hunter Biden's role in the family enterprise, Giuliani said he places the responsibility for Biden's acknowledged and well-documented addictions, including to cocaine and prostitutes, on Biden himself. And this is Giuliani. Admittedly, he's politically opposed to him, you know, but there is an acknowledgement at the New York Times that the messages on the Hunter Biden laptop are authentic. But this has been covered up by the FBI for years now, Martin.
Well, I think the fact that the New York Times have decided to run this at this moment is of significance. It suggests that there are elements within the US state which have decided that they are going to look into some of the aspects of this, possibly in order to try and clip the wings of other elements within the state that they don't like. But I mean, you know, basically all the politicians in the US at the top are part of these rackets. I mean, Giuliani himself is quite likely a 9/11 suspect, for example. So it depends how deep the down the wormhole you want to go. But Biden has been part of the, you know, the deep state in the US for years. I mean, he was the deep state candidate in the Democratic primaries, and that's why they got rid of Sanders. And of course, his son has been, you know, a black sheep, inverted commas, but he's been doing daddy's business all the time. And of course, a lot of that dirty business was done in the Ukraine, one of the most corrupt places on the planet, which is that the politics is run by oligarchs like Kolomoisky and others. And, you know, this is what we're going to war for, folks.
OK, well, let's have a listen now to this time last week. Joe Biden was speaking in Poland, where he called for regime change in Russia, which is a little bit of a cheeky thing for him to do.
Notwithstanding the brutality of Vladimir Putin, let there be no doubt that this war has already been a strategic failure for Russia, already. Having lost children myself, I know that's no solace to the people who've lost family. But he, Putin, thought Ukrainians would roll over and not fight. Not much of a student of history. Ukraine will never be a victory for Russia, for free people refused to live in a world of hopelessness and darkness. We will have a different future, a brighter future, rooted in democracy and principle, hope and light, of decency and dignity, of freedom and possibilities. For God's sake, this man cannot remain in power. God bless you all. And may God defend our freedom, and may God protect our troops.
Well, I assure you that wasn't edited. He seems sort of pedal fast and pedal slow. But for God's sake, Martin, this man cannot remain in power.
Well, what's interesting about that is that the State Department immediately afterwards started saying, oh, he didn't mean to say that. And Biden himself has backtracked on it. So I think what's gone on there is, as often, when he's actually on his own, he goes off piste. Now, in actual fact, the British government have had to say, oh, no, we don't really, really want to overthrow Putin. Now, that doesn't mean that they don't want to overthrow Putin. They clearly do. But if you say that that's what the goal of the sanctions is, then you can't use them as a leverage in a negotiation about Ukraine. The same problem was with the Iranians. Are we really talking to the Iranians about nuclear weapons, or are we talking about regime change?
Well, I mean,
because you can't really talk about both in the same way.
I've got a different take on that, Martin. I think that they love to say these things in public. It's almost as if they're like little schoolboys. I dared to say it. Look, I got away with it. And they think they get kudos for saying the things that they're not supposed to say.
Yeah, but the problem with that is that if you're playing chess and you decide that you're just going to wave your hands about and knock the pieces over, then that's the game of chess finished, isn't it? The problem with Western politicians is that they're in permanent campaign mode. So that's the sort of speech that Putin may have made to an election meeting back in the US. But it's not at all appropriate for a statesman, supposedly, on the brink of World War III. It's just a load of childish name calling, isn't it?
What do you make of these cue cards? It does look as if, he's actually not capable of thinking for himself. He's got to have these little things to remind him what to say in front of the press conferences.
Well, that's clearly true. But the real problem for the people managing him is that without the cue cards, and even with the cue cards, he just comes out with stuff that he's not actually supposed to be saying. Now, it looks, I mean, the way that they responded after he'd said it suggests that he wasn't supposed to say it. I mean, no doubt in private discussions, that's exactly what they've been talking about. It's a bit like Boris Johnson turning up in Parliament saying that the woman in Iran, that was being held by the Iranians wasn't a spy. She was just training journalists, which was no doubt what he'd been briefed by MI6. But in actual fact, she was supposed to be there on holiday. And he was told she's supposed to be there on holiday, but she's training journalists. And he just went out there and told everybody she's training journalists.
Well, yeah, I mean,
and the Iranian just went, aha.
I rather like Boris for that, because he's actually telling the truth and he's not totally.
Well, I don't suppose her family were that impressed.
What the security services wanted him to say, he's actually saying what he believes is the truth. And
no, I don't think. I think he was just
anyway,
too dim
Martin,
to understand he
Martin,
wasn't to say it.
Martin,
to
you're talking about the cue cards here. And I just like to run through, because as some photographers do, they take photographs. It's like when they take photographs of documents when people are going into Downing Street. With these modern cameras, they get a very decent copy of what's on that page. So here we've got tough Putin talking points, it says on the cue card, and then a number one and number two. Now there's a whole bunch of cue cards in his hand, I think, but the number one in bold says, if you weren't advocating for regime change, what did you mean? Can you clarify? And so this is, this is the expected questions from the press, which, of course, could be exactly what an editor has told a journalist to ask, for example, in a controlled system, which, of course, ours not. We have a free press, don't we? And then underneath it there are the answers in non-bold type, with a couple of answers in bullet points, saying, first answer that Joe could read out if he feels like it is, I was expressing the moral outrage I felt towards the actions of this man. Or he might also say, I was not articulating any change in policy. So, they've got a couple of potential ways he can answer that question, which may even have been scripted by an editor to a journalist beforehand. And then we've also got question number two on this particular cue card says, Macron said he would have used the actually it's a little bit obscured by the microphone there. He would have used these. The UK government suggested it was a problem. Is it now threatening to splinter unity within your NATO allies? So I guess he's saying that NATO is looking a little bit potentially splintered by sorts of remarks like this. And in non-bold type underneath. And Joe Biden is told to say, as an answer to that, no, NATO has never been more united. And of course, in the press conference, it said he did just read these out. This is what he said, Martin. This whole thing is scripted. This is not democracy at all, is it?
Well, correct me if I'm wrong here, Tony, but when he made the remark about removing Putin, This is a subsequent press conference where he tried to.
You're quite right. This is the press conference.
So don't mix them up. They're two different things.
It's considered to be a difficult press conference or whatever for him. So he's got exactly a script in front of him. You just read this out,
But it suggests that he wasn't on script in the first place. Now compare that to somebody like Gerry Adams, for example, or Vladimir Putin, or Xi Jinping, or Lavrov. Yeah. There's a big difference in capability there, leaving aside who they represent and what the powers concerned represent. It's just a low level, it's just low level performance. And I'm afraid lots of Western politicians are, in fact, quite low level. And they don't actually, look at Ben Wallace, our defense minister, or Liz Truss. These people are not really, they're way over promoted.
Okay, now let's move on to look more specifically at Ukraine. And I spoke this week to Mark Sloboda. Now, he's ex-US military. A longer version of the interview will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, now teaching international relations, I think it is, over at Moscow State University. And he began by talking to me about, well, not in the longer interview, but we're going to look at that first now, the Russian tactics in Ukraine.
We're talking not the pundits and the talking heads, but actually U.S. military experts on the Russian military. And I'm talking people like Michael Kaufman at the Center for Naval Analysis for the Russian military. And he's also a fellow at the Center for New American Security. Rob Lee, who a similar figure, he finished his postgraduate work at the King's War College in the UK, actually right next to my alma mater, the LSC. He concurs. He's a Foreign Policy Research Institute fellow. The U.S. Colonel Douglas McGregor, after his service in Iraq and Afghanistan, became a major a military advisor to several U.S. presidents since. There's an article out in Newsweek today, yesterday. Putin's bombers could devastate Ukraine, but he's holding back. Here's why. And they go on to cite a large number of serving U.S. military and defense intelligence analysts to say, well, the way that the conflict is being presented is entirely false, actually, that Russia is going out of their way not only to prevent as many civilian casualties as possible, but also to prevent casualties among the regular Ukrainian military, that most of their targeting has been restrained, that actually in the first 24 days of the conflict, Russia launched less air sorties and strikes than the United States did in the first day of the Iraq war, right? One day. This is not a shock and awe campaign. A lot has been played up when you have seen these battalions or perhaps some of the Ukrainian military take up residence in what had previously been civilian buildings, provoking the Russian military to fire on them and then claiming some type of mass attack on civilians, despite the fact that there's only been, the civilian deaths is in the hundreds at this point after a month of this large scale military combat. And Russia has actually hindered and slowed and caused a lot of problems for the goals of their military operation by this. And it has resulted in a lot more Russian military deaths than is necessary in pursuit of these goals and may have, really thrown a wrench actually into it. And that's why U.S. military analysts have had such a hard problem understanding what Russia is doing there.
So that's Mark Sloboda. Longer version of that interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk really does get down deep into what he believes is going on there. Martin, there certainly does seem to be a certain amount of restraint from the Russians. And yet what we're being told is that they're losing. We've got the situation with the bulk of the Ukrainian army, which was there in Lugansk and Donetsk, in the parts which the Ukrainians were shelling civilians in the in those breakaway republics, that is now completely surrounded. Well, it was very quickly surrounded by the Russian army. And even if they were to try and fight back towards Kiev, fight west through the Russians, which is possible, it's exactly what the Russians would rather like them to do, because that's going away from the areas that the Russian speaking people claim as their own through referenda, then there would be another pincer waiting for them west, wouldn't there?
Well, that's right. I mean, that's a more general stuff about the actual fighting and how it's going. But I mean, coming back to the point about civilian casualties, the UN, who are relatively independent, has put the civilian casualties in the hundreds. But they've also said that the majority of those civilian casualties have actually been in Donetsk and Luhansk. So we're hearing about the terrible bombings in Mariupol and Kiev and all the rest of it. But in downtown Donetsk, a cluster bomb killed 20 people on a trolley bus about 3 weeks ago. And the Italian press even put pictures of that out, pointing out how horrific Putin's war was and all the rest of it. And then they shamefacedly said, well, actually, we knew it was in Donetsk where that happened, but we're just making a general point about how bad the war is. And the war is bad. War is bad. Now, I don't suppose anybody listening to this doubts that for a moment. The question is, you know, why do we have military forces at all in the world? Why are wars taking place? And that is the big question.
Mark, we'll be looking at that again in a minute. But Mark, in the longer interview, I think does a fantastic job in pulling it all apart. So that is a really good listen. But he also said he thinks that I asked him about what he thought was the going to be, how long will the Ukraine war last, and also what was going to be the ultimate effect on the freedom of the press. He thinks that actually the internet is going to be now clamped down on more than ever before, as we've seen, for example, with the blocking of apps from RT, the blocking of the Sputnik radio website has somehow been blocked by off of the internet. Unless you go via Iceland or something, you might be able to get it from there. But I mean, he says that the death of the internet is looming.
There's a big thread on the top of my Twitter. I call it a big, long thread that talks through all the consequences of this conflict and the existential war of sanctions. And I talk that this is one of the things is of the great decoupling. And this is the end of the golden age of the internet, of the global internet. And you will tell your kids about it. And we're going to be looking at a splintered and much more controlled internet everywhere going forward.
Amazing. Anyway, look, the $64,000 question, when is this operation in Ukraine going to be over? How long?
Never. 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 There's going to be a forever war, I mean, in Ukraine. The country was too socially, politically divided to begin with. This whole chain has been set off. Russia cannot militarily occupy West Ukraine without a bloody insurgency that will last forever. And, it can't be reversed in Eastern Ukraine. The West would face a bloody insurgency, what has happened in the Donbass for the last 8 years there as well. Humpty Dumpty has fallen, and all the king's horses and men can't put it back together again. Ukraine will probably end up being a Balkanized state with a number of localized conflicts going forward. And I don't expect relations between the West and Russia and increasingly China and, you know, the other parts of that bloc to ever return to what they were. We're now in a new world order, a new international system. This is one of those big pivot points in history. It's happening right now. You want to talk about an iron wall or a new Cold War or, great power conflict, but it's here. It's now. It's happening right now. And our lives are all going to be changed coming out the other side, mostly for the worse.
Well, I did try and get Mark to say something positive. What do you think, Martin? First of all, the death of the internet, and also there, this is going to be a never-ending war in Ukraine, he thinks.
Well, I'm old enough to remember when there was no internet, and there were ways to find out what was going on in the world. So I used to have to subscribe to various journals like Lobster, for example, or Le Monde Diplomatique, So, you know, we used to get information. It was much slower, obviously. But, you know, if that's what we have to do, that's what we'll have to do, is what I'd say about that.
And what about the never-ending war, though?
Well, I think that is a bit too pessimistic, because I think what the Russians have done is they've kept talking. Don't forget, Zelensky and the Ukrainians refused to talk for 8 years. And the Russians, even before they carried out their operation, said, are you prepared to talk to us about this, or rather to talk to the rebels? And they said no. And they said, right, here we go. And then immediately Zelensky picked up the phone and said, can I talk to you, please? Now, of course, these talks are very fraught, because Kiriev, who is one of the Ukrainian delegates to these talks, was shot dead by the SBU, which is the Ukrainian secret police, when he returned from one of these discussions. Now, that, of course, should have been reported in the Western media. It should have been on BBC News. One of the top Ukrainian negotiators has been shot dead by his own secret police. Because that would present a rather different image of the government in Kiev than the one that we're being presented with.
Martin, this week we've had a certain amount of, apparently the Russians are laying off in Kiev, haven't we?
Yeah, but that's because I don't believe that they intend. What they want to do is to liberate the Donetsk and Luhansk, which voted in 2014 to secede from the Ukraine, just as, you know, Slovenia voted to secede from Yugoslavia, which we supported at the time. And so, and the Russians have been very, very patient with all of this for 8 years.
Can you just be as concise as you can, please? We're going to have a listen now to Michael Hudson, who has got a very interesting take, I think, anyway, on the blowback that's coming from the sanctions. It almost seems as if the sanctions are going to be almost designed to affect the West and, you know, negatively more than Russia. So that's Michael Hudson now.
The United States just grabbed all of Russia's foreign exchange reserves, just as England a few months ago grabbed all of Venezuela's gold that was held in the Bank of England when Venezuela tried to spend this gold on buying medical supplies to cope with the COVID virus. So basically, the United States has said if any foreign country holds its reserves in the United States or accounts in U.S. banks, if a country in the global south tries to pay its foreign debt by holding its reserves in U.S. banks in order to be the paying agent on the interest due on its foreign debt, and if that foreign country does something we don't like trade with Russia or permit more labor unionization or tries to become independent in food, we're just going to do what we did to Venezuela, what we did to Iran when we granted its foreign exchange reserves, or what we did to Russia. That means that other countries all of a sudden see what they thought was their flight to security, what they thought was their most secure savings, the holdings in U.S. banks and U.S. Treasury bills, all of a sudden is holding them hostage and is a high risk. Even the Financial Times of London has been writing about this, saying, how can the United States, that was getting a free ride off the dollar standard for the last 50 years, ever since 1971, when foreign countries held dollars instead of gold, and basically holding dollars means you buy U.S. Treasury bonds to finance the U.S. budget deficit and the balance of payments deficit. How can the United States kill the goose that's given it the free ride? Well, the answer is that other countries can only move into gold and is an alternative to the dollar, because that's something that all the countries of the world have agreed upon is an asset that's not a liability. If you hold any foreign currency, that currency is a liability of a foreign country. And if you hold gold, it's a pure asset. There's no country that can cancel it. The Americans can't cancel Russia's gold supply that's held in Russia, although it can grab Russia's gold supply if it were to hold it in the New York Federal Reserve Bank or the Bank of England. So other countries are not only moving to gold. Germany is bringing its gold back from New York, from the Federal Reserve, in airplanes back to Germany, so it'll have its old gold, just in case Germany would, politicians would do something the United States didn't like, and the United States would simply grab Germany's gold. The United States sanctions, and it's especially its grabbing of foreign reserves, has started a war that is dividing the world between the West and Eurasia.
That's one of the greatest economists in the world, Michael Hudson there. Martin, it sounds to me as if the deep state is in the process and very busy committing suicide of America, you know, killing its own country. And this possibly this week, what we've seen with the switch over from oil from the dollar to the ruble could be the end of the dollar.
I think, what is it Hemingway said about how did you go bankrupt? And he said, slowly and then really quick. What's happened in the last week is the beginning of the quick phase of the bankruptcy of the US empire. They haven't got a lot of good options because they've backed themselves into a corner by their stupid attitude going back to the 1980s. But they are choosing the worst of the bad options in front of them. And that, in a way, is a hope for humanity because they are really, really far more evil than most people realise. But the other thing is, they are clearly incompetent, having watched them operate
throughout my lifetime. You take that attitude. I think there's an element of deliberate incompetence here. The kind of
they think they can profit from the crash.
The lords of chaos, actually deliberately creating chaos and then hoping to control the outcome. Anyway, we're going to hear now from a Dutch academic, Kees van der Peel, who actually was teaching at Sussex University for quite a long time. And he's just come out with a book called Pandemic of Fear, which has got, I think, a fascinating take on the he hasn't just come out with it, he's come out with it a while ago actually, and he's got an English and a US edition of it, and you can hear, as you will be able to hear Michael Hudson, the full version of that interview, you'll be able to hear the full version of this interview that I did this week with Kees van der Peel. I've been after this guy for years, finally managed to pin him down. Is this whole idea that there are lots and lots of people in the world out there that the elite like to are getting a bit nervous about, because people like the Arab Spring, etc., are getting a bit angry. And so what are they going to do about it? Anyway, he looks at that in his book, Pandemic of Fear.
In hindsight, it turned out that from the 1990s, after the Soviet Union collapsed, and let's say the bottom of political consensus in the West fell out of it, you know, that there was no longer a sort of backstop to convince people that whatever might happen, you still had to be against communism and so on and so forth, and side with your government. After 1991, it turned out that on the one hand, that sort of basic political consensus fell away, but also the capitalist system as such was no longer capable of offering a meaningful social contract to its citizens. And in that period, you see that a number of important conferences are taking place, and also, you know, ideological experiments like the idea of Huntington, of a clash of civilizations and so on. But I think especially of a conference held under the chairmanship of Philip Zelikow of 9/11 fame. Zelikow was the director of the Miller Center of the University of Virginia, and he organized a conference about how political science should be rethought to be prepared for the coming period. And in that he said that if you look back on political history, you would see that, for instance, an event like Pearl Harbor inspired a whole generation of citizens to side with the government, because basically they had been witness to an event of such magnitude and of such a shock that it would be useful to reconsider whether, if something like that happened again, we wouldn't have another 30 years in which there would be a consensus about why it was proper to follow your government in this or in that. And the idea of a politics of fear was therefore slowly worked out in the 1990s. And in 2003, there was actually this famous BBC documentary about how the American dream had evaporated, and you now had the power of nightmares. So you could make people fearful, and with people who are in fear, who live in fear, you can do a lot. And in my view, if you look at the figures, it was obvious that in May, June 2020, whatever pandemic or epidemic there had been, it had passed. And in the book, I list a number of highly placed experts who came to that conclusion, that it was best to quickly revert to normalcy to avoid further panic and so on and so forth. But what actually happened was that the panic was kept going by making reference to number of infected people and all kind of calculus, you know, all kind of figures that really made very little sense in an epidemiological sense. But worked very well if the media were on side and were helping to spread this deep unease. You know, don't forget that a virus is unlike the Russians or even terrorism. A virus is a very handy theme to instill fear in people. Because it's you can't see it. People associate it with illness and even death, as in the case of AIDS. And so, in that sense, it worked excellently. And to my own surprise, when I started investigating this in greater depth, I was surprised to see that already in the late 1980s. There had been conferences about bioterrorism and the responses to it, and how the population might be brought on board in a repressive policy, you know, in which people would gladly surrender their freedoms just to make sure that they would be protected against the horrors of an unknown illness and so on and so forth. So,
well, this is quite worrying. I just wonder if you can pick out a couple of points that you make in the book without spoiling things for people, you know, what are the central things that you've concluded?
Well, the basic argument, and that's best brought out in the American edition, which is called States of Emergency, and the subtitle of that is Keeping the Global Population in Check. And the main argument in the book is that, especially after 2008, people all across the globe have become restive. So I wasn't so much aware of that before I looked at the figures. But if you look at statistics for strikes, for anti-government demonstrations, for occupations, for actual revolutions like the Arab Spring and so on, but also in France, for instance, the Yellow Vest. If you look at all these statistics, you see that especially after 2008, the year of the final financial collapse, you might say, these statistics have all gone up, and not just that, they've broken all existing records. And that means that after 2008, the ruling classes of the world, and that again reverts back to these networks, you know, ruling class is a very abstract term, but if you think of these networks like Bilderberg, Trilateral, World Economic Forum, and so on and so forth, in all these networks, the focus increasingly became, how are we keeping this restive mass and rapidly growing mass? Don't forget, in 1970, when I started work in Amsterdam, there were 4 billion people on Earth. Today, we're approaching 8 billion. So we have seen a doubling of the world population. And in a digital capitalism, a capitalism that we're rapidly approaching now, that's, you know, digitalization is being introduced in every nook and cranny of the economy and public administration and so on, many of these people will be superfluous. And calculations have been made about something like 2 billion people literally being unnecessary in the society that would come if the capitalist system would continue and would enter the modernization stage that is now being made possible by digitalization, so by the internet and by everything that's associated with it. So that's the bottom line. The bottom line is the ruling classes are faced with a world population that's getting more and more rebellious, that is becoming aware of the fact that for many of them, and of course among the young, that's always the most alive, for many of them there won't be any future role, there won't be, certainly not a guaranteed minimum existence and so on. And the virus option, just as before it, the terror option, the idea of the threat posed by Russia and perhaps also China, that these are instances of a politics of fear in which, at least in the short run, the ruling classes hope to keep the masses divided, at bay, under control, etc. And that's not just a matter of Western capitalism. It's also a matter of China, for instance. I saw some video images the other day of the city of Shenzhen, which is the hub of Chinese high-tech industry opposite Hong Kong. And you could see that the police was no longer able to contain furious masses who were protesting a renewed lockdown that was being imposed there. So in that sense, the lockdowns have been a response, just as the terror scares were a response, to a population that is increasingly difficult to control and to whom the ruling classes have less and less to offer in terms of, you know, a stable future, a future of work, proper chances for their children to study and so on, being taken care of should you fall ill and you name it. So that's the argument of the book.
No, the book's called Pandemic of Fear. That was Dutch academic Kees van der Peel. Martin, what do you reckon to this whole idea of these mega ideas? I mean, this is a massive thing, isn't it? The idea that the ruling classes of the planet have decided on various tactics to control the masses who are getting restive. As they're having democracy stolen from them all over the world, maybe these annoying people might do something about it.
Well, there's a lot there that I agree with, but I think that the Russian exposure of the biological warfare labs in Ukraine and the Chinese government picking up on that suggests that the plandemic was planned and it included a virus created by the deep state in the West. It's not just about fear, because you're trying to make people fearful. You make them fearful by attacking them and hurting them. And then they've got a reason to be fearful. The 9/11 attack was a real attack and loads of people died. It wasn't just a simulacrum any more than the epidemic, plandemic was.
He's talking about the power of nightmares, isn't he? The idea.
Well, but the problem, the Adam Curtis thing that he's talking about, my objection to that is it's too much about ideology and not enough about
warfare. He's talking about you can have a terrorism narrative, a COVID narrative, but actually it's not about what's actually happening on the ground. The point is the narrative is creating an entire narrative of fear. The idea is that people are being told to be afraid of something, whether it's COVID or terrorism, that isn't anywhere near as much of a threat to their life as they might know.
Yeah, but I come back to my point that this is all on the level of narrative. In actual fact, there are also hurtful actions. The terrorists in Syria, ISIS, have tried to smash the country.
Nobody
there's is ideology saying, involved, but there's also nobody, killing and murdering.
Nobody is saying that there are not, I mean, as we, you know, nobody's saying there's not actions happening. But what we've had for example, from David Miller is that the actual chance of somebody being involved in some sort of Islamic terror attack or Islamist terror attack is minuscule. There are all sorts of other things. For example, the far right terror attacks, which may be far more dangerous. Anyway, I think Kees van der Peel's book, The Pandemic of Fear, is well worth a look at. And I'll put a link up to that on our show page as well as the longer interview. But we're going to move on now to have a look at, you know, what I like to do at the end of the show. So maybe we can say goodbye, Martin. Martin, would you like to bow out now?
I'm happy to bow out and have my
tea. All right, Martin. Later. Martin Summers, thanks very much. But we're going to hear now from a chap called William Stewart, who's done a lot of work on the Milner Group, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Royal Institute for International Affairs, and what he calls Armageddon Freemasonry.
You'll see that the Council of Foreign Relations, Bilderberg Trilaterals in the USA, hope to control foreign affairs in America and the military, as well as having people like White House President Carter in the Trilateral Commission itself. So you see, foreign affairs and a lot of what happens can be influenced by people who have never been elected and who have an actual agenda. And because people don't know about the agenda, they will not be able to explain what is happening in an area, for instance, like the Middle East. So there you've got just some cases of 1881, and these issues will then dovetail into things that happen a bit later on.
So let's talk about Armageddon Masonry. How does that all come in then?
Here, Armageddon Masonry, which belongs to the Red Lodges that I've been talking about, which belong to the Lombard bankers who are now operating from Venice, Geneva, and presumably from their round table in Britain and their round table in America, as indeed in the modern world from elsewhere. You could hop over to the Cayman Islands in 5 seconds. But here we've got Armageddon Masonry, and it is attached to these secretive lodges that are run by bankers. Now, you might say you must be stark raving mad to come across with an idea like Armageddon Masonry. That is the creation, deliberate creation of 7 strategic wars. But I suppose, in a way, the culprits, the bankers, must have slipped up a little bit in that Armageddon Masonry is described in various books. It is, for instance, in the dictionary of A.E. Waite, the Dictionary of Freemasonry. There you will find that and 7 seals described at the same time. So it's not such a guess after all. There is such a thing. They are working to this plan, and I have found it. Lombard agent Conti, who was really basically behind the initial structures in the 1700s, was a defrocked priest, as many of these agents were, actually. They operated the Central Bank of Venice. They were in the church. They did unpleasant things and were thrown out. So there you've got a defrocked priest who knows every word of the Bible and who has decided that one of the big jokes will be to use the Book of Revelation to savage Europe, America, and Britain. I'm going to talk just now about what I have found. Now, you note that when Israel was founded, the Rothschilds were recruiting Armageddon people who actually believed that the State of Israel needed Armageddon before it could spread to the territories that it should have. That's not talking about or average Israelis or families or their government. We're talking about something that actually happened, but it was separate from what you'd expect. In the Middle East, there are numerous lodges of the Templars, founded in Saudi Arabia in 1710, exported to Turkey and other nations. And here, people trained to see good as evil, evil as good, and they planned to conduct the strategic wars I've talked about. And we have their statement of Mazzini and Albert Pike, an American Red Mason, on 3 world wars, which they discussed in some detail. So first of all, Armageddon looks very possible simply because you've got these lodges spread throughout the Middle East. Then you've got the Hamas Armageddon. Again, this is a branch, although they say it isn't. It is a branch of the Muslim Brotherhood founded by the East India Company, founded by the Lombard bankers. It's from the Islamic resistance movement, which taught Gog and Magog, which is basically saying Armageddon, the killing of Jews and the Arabs' apocalyptic rise to full power. Palestine to them is a religious trust consecrated for Muslim use until Judgment Day, when the Jews and the Arabs will fight. So deep down inside Hamas, you've not only got the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is the thing that took the Jews into the Holocaust, Then there's the Israeli Armageddon. This comes mainly today through the right wing of Israel, the Irgun, Gog and Magog again, the Armageddon in Israel, which is an apocalyptic war in which Israel would rise to new power in the region. Members actually wish for this return of God and a religious battle. All of Palestine, etc., would be theirs, and such agents were, of course, supported by the main mega or main bankers, including the Rothschilds. Then there's one you don't know about, perhaps, and that's the Christian Armageddon. And Christians have been trained to the Scofield Bible, which says we've got to have rapture and we've got to have Armageddon, it's coming soon. In 2002, 371 of them were sent to Israel. They expected to create a Jewish state, one suitable and ready to experience the second coming of Jesus as the act of Armageddon. And the Scofield Bible was, of course, their guide to this, but then the Scofield Bible was made by the mega bankers. In 1991, a large meeting of such Christians took place in Basel, Switzerland, where they announced the near presence of the second coming called Armageddon. So don't let's say that we're dealing with something that is not provable. There is an occult lodge Armageddon, Hamas, Israelis, and Christian.
So that's William Stewart there, his book. I've not got a hold of a copy of it, but it'd be nice to get hold. I did actually get an email off William once. But he wasn't able to do an interview. The book is called 9-11 to Armageddon, Bankers Plan Wars. Absolutely fascinating stuff. And a lot of that, you know, he echoes much of what, you know, various other people. I'm trying to think of the guy's name. He was, I'll think of it in a minute, have said about the long-term plan, Freemasonry and Israel. We're going to hear now from a guy called Jean-Pierre de Smet. Now, he had a look at this Albert Pike letter, which, you know, is, well, I mean, you know, a lot of people say, oh, the whole thing's just a fantasy. But hang on a minute. Various people made copies of it, copied it out before it disappeared from the British Museum. Now, documents are made to disappear from archives. Most definitely, that's one of the things that is a method to control history. We came across it. I came across it with my fellow researchers like Dave Barnby in the looking at the Battle of Arnhem, where it turned out that the intelligence file on Christian Lindemann's King Kong, the spy that went and told the Nazis a few days before the Abwehr in Eindhoven that Operation Market Garden, the Bridge Too Far parachutists were about to come in and gave them the plans away, his intelligence file disappeared. So maybe it never existed at all, or maybe the people who are at such a high level, they managed to cover these things up and try and rewrite history as it's happening. But anyway, let's have a listen now to the Albert Pike letter. Jean-Pierre de Smet will tell us about how that explains the wars that we've had, the First World War, the Second World War, and a coming potential Third World War.
Now, Albert Pike wrote a letter to Mancini, and that was dated August 15, 1871, in which he propagated that there should be a world order, a one order where all nations are under the control of one central organization. And in order to achieve this, they plan the First World War, to overthrow the power of the Tsars in Russia, protector of orthodoxy, and bring about an atheistic communistic state. Did that happen? The Second World War. That's also written long before the event. To originate between Great Britain and Germany, to strengthen communism as antithesis to the Judeo-Christian culture, and bring about a Zionist state in Israel. Did it achieve this objective? Yes. In fact, after this war, Israel, in its present form, was reinstated under the protection of Britain. And then, interestingly enough, a Third World War, a Middle Eastern war involving Judaism and Islam and spreading internationally. Well, here's another quote, just in case people don't like that quote. Mancini with Pike developed a plan for three world wars so that eventually every nation would be willing to surrender its national sovereignty to a world government. The first war was to end the Tsarist regime in Russia, the second to allow the Soviet Union to control Europe, the third world war was to be in the Middle East between Muslim and Jews and would result in Armageddon. Interesting. Now, how were they going to do it? Let's read what Albert Pike wrote about these wars and how they were going to be unleashed. He wrote, quote, "We shall unleash the nihilist and the atheist," so the destroyer and the atheist, "and we will provoke a formidable social cataclysm which in its horror will show clearly to the nations the effect of absolute atheism. Origin of savagery and the most bloody turmoil. Then everywhere the citizens obliged to defend themselves against the minority of revolutionaries will exterminate these destroyers of civilization, and the multitude, disillusioned with Christianity, will receive the pure light through the universal manifestation of the pure doctrine of Lucifer. The destruction of Christianity and atheism, both conquered and exterminated at the same time." Wow, what a clever plan. So you rub the two systems which you create up against the other. You create atheism as an antithesis to the Judeo-Christian culture. You have these two clash until they rub each other up. And then out of that, you will get a new world order where you have a new religion which is far more esoteric and actually honors Satan. Isn't that a rather clever plan?
Well, how interesting. That's Jean-Pierre de Smet talking about the 15th of August 1871 Albert Pike letter to Mazzini, which may have never existed at all in the British Museum. But then again, why did all these people copy it before it disappeared? So an interesting concept anyway, that you've got a kind of potential Zionist messiah coming along in the future who would be the Antichrist, in other words, denying the original Christ, and then that would invoke the second coming of Jesus Christ eventually, because obviously this Zionist messiah, the Antichrist, was a fake version of Jesus. But the interesting thing about it all, of course, is the idea of provoking some sort of fight between the atheists and these fake religious people like the Zionists, the Christian Zionists, and people who have hijacked Islam too. So to create that fight, the idea is that you then discredit those Judeo-Christian faiths, and then you come along with your new religion, which is where our final clip tonight, David Livingstone, comes in.
The New Age movement, of course, traces back to the influence of H.P. Blavatsky, and probably most directly to Alice Bailey, one of her more popular students. So Alice Bailey with this other woman named Olga, I can't remember exactly her last name. They founded what's called the Aranos conferences that involved Carl Jung. So these were a series of conferences that basically gave birth to the study of what they call the history of religions that took place in Switzerland. Every year, I think starting around 1932, connected very much to what's called the German Conservative Revolution, which is the movement that basically gave rise to the Nazi Party. And so when Michael Murphy founded the Esalen Institute, he confessed and said categorically that it was inspired by the Aranos conferences. And you find that even in the San Francisco Renaissance is basically a confluence of the influences of, people who belong to the Aranos conferences and who influenced by the German Conservative Revolution. So it's just to say that, the New Age movement has a fascist origin. And as wishy-washy and hokey as the Esalen Institute might have seen, under all that is a fascist strain. So ultimately, the New Age movement, their goal is to transition humanity into this age of Aquarius, which is basically a satanic age, and a satanic, a fascist age. And so this is why when you look at the teachings, so basically what Ike is doing is effectively merging this idea of a conspiracy with the coming age of Aquarius. So basically, you know, what's happening now. This is what I cover in my article. If you look at what's happening with COVID, is that there seems to be a deliberate strategy because Facebook has been targeting the wellness or new age community with QAnon content. So what's happening is that people who are used to those sort of alternative healing practices and beliefs, who have a sort of a typical mistrust of the current medical establishment, are starting to perceive their opposition to it as part of as being rooted in a conspiracy, and it's because of the right wing influences, it's being identified as a right wing conspiracy. So that's why when most of the opposition that's coming out these days, it tends to be floated by the right. So Fox News is jumping on the bandwagon. You know, people like Tucker Carlson, Ben Shapiro, Rebel News in Canada, who have a hand in the trucker protest in Ottawa. So, it's just part of the way that the fascist underground is again using, manipulating perceptions of the conspiracy to advance their agenda, which is to accelerate, to create chaos, to accelerate the coming of the Antichrist, who is supposed to be arrive with the coming of the Age of Aquarius.
So, David Livingston there, give me a pretty good summary, I think, of, interesting to see the Green Party in Germany this week being very pro-NATO, as they are generally. I mean, which is bizarre, isn't it, to see these so-called left-wing groups suddenly swerving behind our wonderful military-industrial complex. And also Tucker Carlson, I mean, who knows what's going on with that? Maybe because he's doing such good work on exposing the Ukraine war and the pandemic, that he's actually, there's something else that's going to come out through Tucker in the future, David seems to be suggesting. It's already coming out to do with, Tucker is the man to lead the global awakening, but isn't this just going to be dragging people further into a kind of dark world? So I think we just need to be quite careful in what we're following people, following individuals, rather than what we can see and perceive ourselves to be true and not to be true. Don't follow leaders. Also just a reminder of the Kees van der Peel, his book is called Pandemic of Fear. In Dutch, it's Pandemic van der Angst, which is, this angst is a great word. It's it means just a sort of feeling of things aren't quite right. And it's also states of emergency, which is the idea of using these state of emergencies in order to control people, because we're as the fascists take over the new world order in the West, they know that people aren't going to like it. So they're going to make sure that we have states of emergency to keep us in check. Time to sign off now. Thanks very much to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also to sound engineer Dave Bazenko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast to download and listen in the car or anywhere you like, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. That's at thisweekoneword.org.uk. You can subscribe to my weekly email list there and even donate if you fancy. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. My books about the Allies and the Nazis during the war, that is The Traitors of Arnhem, costs £15. And my secret government anthology, From Cromwell to the Princess Diana assassination, is £20. Those are actual paper books, but you can also get those two and one other, which is one of my articles, as an e-book too, if you fancy. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week. Except when we are restreaming the Richie Allen Show. That is here on the PRSC stream. Also, it's over on Saturday and Sunday at camberleysradioqUK.com. Do feel free, please, to make live recordings. So, we've been streaming via the People's Republic of Stokescroft in Bristol and at radioqUK.com in Camberley. Surrey, censorship and military disinformation is sadly the norm in Britain today, thanks to the Nazi collaborators. Definitely Nazi collaborators who own the transmitters and the printing presses. The glorious Fourth Reich. So if you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and I'll credit you here. And of course, anyone that says things they don't like, they just buy them out using banks, not tanks. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock, we hope, next Friday. I'll put a note up if it has to be a bit later again. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Lots of land under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze and listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please, don't fence me in.
Just turn me loose, let me straddle my old saddle underneath the western sky. On my cayuse, let me wander over yonder till I see the mountains rise.
I want a ride to the ridge where the west commences and gaze at the moon till I lose my senses. And I can't look at hobbles and I can't stand fences. Don't fence me in.
Lots of land under starry skies. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide country that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze and listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please, don't fence me in.
Just turn me loose, let me straddle my old saddle underneath the western skies.
On my cayuse, let me wander over yonder till I see the mountains rise.
Ba 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 ba. I want to ride to the ridge where the west commences and gaze at the moon till I lose my senses. And I can't look at hobbles and I can't stand fences. Don't fence me in, no.
Papa, don't you fence me in.